It's fire.
And welcome to Shattered Lives, a lively, educational, and issues-driven radio show designed to tell another side of the story, to focus on and humanize crime victims, to enlighten and shine the spotlight on organizations and service providers, and to assist those who walk the path with us. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, and Delilah Jones, president of ImaginePublicity.com, welcoming you as your hosts each and every Saturday evening. And so I welcome you this January Saturday. And our show promises to be another interesting and lively show with another brand new guest. And before I bring him in, I'd like to welcome Delilah in. Delilah, good evening. How are you?
Hey, Donna, I'm doing great. It's a little chilly down in my neck of the woods, and I'm sure it's not quite as chilly as it is up in your neck of the woods, but still.
Still
it's
hanging
cold.
In there, right?
It's still wintertime, yeah. Yeah.
I know. Well, I've got two brief questions for you. One is, I just wanted to remind the listeners coming up, this is getting to be midway January, but I'm in a bragging mood, and I just want to brag that you and I have done this radio show for nearly 2 years, Delilah. Can you believe that? What can you,
time goes
what comes to mind when I say that to you?
Well, what really comes to mind is the wonderful job that you've done on your end as far as facilitating the wonderful guests that we've had. You've got a knack for getting some very, very good people, and just like the guests that we have today, I've watched David LeBon's work over the years and through other people, so I've admired him from afar, so to speak, and I'm very excited to have him on and to talk with him and get to know him a little better, and you know, who knows what the future might bring, right?
Yes, indeed. I like to say that it's never just a one-shot deal with our guests. They're part of our collaborative family. And just kudos out there to Jennifer Bishop Jenkins, who facilitated our introduction in this radio show. Thank you, Jennifer. We love you. And so I hope you'll be listening. Without further ado, let me just give a very brief introduction to our guest. David LeBon is a prosecutor by profession. He started out over 20 years ago, maybe 28 if I do the math correctly, in California, in the Sacramento area, and then other areas, specializing in sexual assault, victim rights, and a number of other things, some homicide cases. And then I think he probably had an epiphany and said, hey, we can help crime victims as well as prosecutors in another way. And he founded his own nonprofit organization, and he is currently the president and chief executive officer of the Association for Prosecuting Attorneys. And we're going to focus much of our hour on that, as well as asking how it impacts crime victims. So without further ado, David, thank you. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to have you on Shattered Lives, and welcome.
Well, good evening, Donna and Delilah. It's a pleasure to be on your show, and I, too, am amazed at all the activities and things you've been able to do and had no idea it had been 2 years, so congratulations.
Well, thank you. I like to say it's a labor of fun, and it's a lot of fun as well. We do serious topics, but yet, you know, we have to sometimes laugh at ourselves when those tragic things happened, and until we find answers. And you know, you seem to have found a different way to help people. And much of our show focuses on the aftermath of crime, and a lot of what you have done for a profession also deals with that. And so why don't we discuss? We could go at it from many areas, but I'm wondering if you could tell people, since it's sort of a showcase of what you do right now, what is the Association for Prosecuting Attorneys about? Why did you create it? Was there something lacking in our system? And, you know, what areas of the APA can create the greatest impact?
Well, I'll certainly try, and I'm going to use the phrase that you started with, talking about me having an epiphany. So I think
okay.
I will go back over.
I was
over
right,
20.
Huh?
Yeah, it's all an epiphany. There is never anything new, especially there's never anything new in the criminal justice system, in the sense that many things keep coming back around. That it's a human system. That the tragedies and the pain that individuals can inflict upon others is truly unbelievable. Going to my own life, my own experience, I'm one of those folks that went to law school, had no thought about being a prosecutor, no thought about victims' rights. The very first contact I even had from a district attorney's office or a prosecutor's office was during college, when one of my professors let us out of class early and went and executed or killed his wife, laying in wait homicide. So it was pretty amazing, and he was a philosophy professor, one of these free thinkers. But you kind of see he had a little bit of a dark side to him, but it was also an introduction into domestic violence issues in homicide. So up until then, crime had really not even touched my life, other than living in an urban area, you know, had my bike stolen. You can talk about a dozen radios that were busted out of my car. You know, those sort of things that happen to folks in more
urban. To everybody, huh?
Yeah, they uh-huh. happen to everybody. I think 12, I'm pretty high on the number, but, you know, California folks like their cars, and other people decide they need the radios and, you know, different objects
right.
in the cars more than you do. So, but a very long way of saying, initially even becoming a prosecutor, that it was a good pathway coming out of law school. If you wanted some trial experience, why not join the prosecutor's office? I started clerking in a firm, and one of the most impressive people was a former prosecutor, and he reinforced, look, go to the prosecutor's office, get the experience, see what it's like, handle cases, you talk about victims' issues, you know, help, do the help you can do. Can you help the victims? You can never restore them to the place they were before they were victimized, but you can help them go from being a victim to a survivor. Mm-hmm. And so that's very much the way I got into it, and that would go back to the early 80s. And also in all of that, I never thought I'd be a career prosecutor. I never thought, here we are in 2014, sitting here talking about criminal justice issues, probably figured 2 years, and then jumped to a civil firm using the trial experience, and then, you know, joined the typical law firm and other pathways.
Mm-hmm.
However, as you just described, and I call it a 10, 10, and 8, here we are 28 years later. I am still very much involved in the criminal justice system and very much involved trying to fix it. The epiphany moment does go back when you start handling cases and dealing with victims and dealing with court issues. The system is not balanced. And going back to the 80s, at least the 80s in California, was kind of the beginning of the victims' rights movement, but there was a very, very long way to go. We're still not perfect. We're better in some states rather than others. But trying to say that although the scales are always going to tilt, and until we can get a constitutional amendment for the victims, all the constitutional rights are on behalf of the defendant. And so if anything is shall we say, equal, it's always going to go the defendant's ways. There's always going to be that question. Any sort of timing, trial issues, you name it, it's going to inure to the benefit of the defendant. So that's sort of the epiphany, that's sort of the battle, and there's no way to be involved on prosecutor issues without having a thought towards where are the victims' issues? How is this impacting? Because the victims is ultimately its impact upon society, both mm-hmm. individually and collectively. How do we fix that? How do we make it better? And not only how do we do things reactively, talk about my work on behalf of APA here in D.C., how can we also be proactive? Do we have to keep waiting for people to be victimized? Or can we look and see, are there ways to reduce crime, to reduce that hurt and that pain?
Mm-hmm. Did you see how
now you're talking?
Yeah.
I said, now you're talking. I mean, that's something I bring up almost every week when we talk about the criminal justice system, is how our whole system, you know, all across society is in a reactive basis. And where do we turn that around? How do we flip that balance of the scales to where we are more proactive and preventative in our way of thinking and where our funding goes? I think that's a little bit of it, is all, you know, so much of the funding goes into the reaction of a crime and the case and the attorneys involved and the prosecutors involved and the jails and the prisons and right. Where is it going on the other end? There's very, very little.
Instead of prevention, yeah. So you're absolutely right, Delilah, really. And it's a refrain that we've been saying. So maybe if people like David and other people keep saying it and doing what they're doing, then it will happen eventually, maybe with a trickle-down effect. I don't know. But so did you feel with having this good sense of you know, we can't change much with respect to the system as it is. You couldn't affect as much change in the system by going sort of outside of the system and creating your own entity, that was the best way to approach it, David?
Certainly. What I will say in my own experience and what I've been trying to do is, as a trial prosecutor, you can do the very best you can and try to have an effect on the cases of which you're handling. It's a very first person. Can you seek justice, hold folks fully accountable, and within whatever that community is that you're working, can you try to make it better? Can you each day go into work, hey, did I make the world a better place today?
Mm-hmm.
Then at the county level, and we can chat a little bit about, you know, how our prosecutors what are the roles and names and jurisdictions, but whoever the elected prosecutor is kind of gets you into that, now at least that sort of second person, is they can have an impact on whatever the jurisdiction is. They can work on strategies. We do a lot with community prosecution and zone prosecution, trying to break up large jurisdictions into their respective communities, and then within that community now there's a greater opportunity to work with the victims, to work with the officers, to, you know, we're never going to be perfect as far as being proactive, but trying mm-hmm. to not only address the current crime in front of us, but why is this happening? Is there anything that can be done as a strategy to reduce the overall harm going on in that community? In my own life, my next step was then to deal with things at the state level. And in many ways, with bad legislation that occurs, as a former trial attorney, it's a little bit easier because you don't have to go out and face the victim and say, hey, the jury just did not believe you. You know, the individual's going to be out in the street tomorrow. When you're dealing with legislation, some of the early release bills and things that have happened, you do everything you can trying to stop them within the Capitol, but if that's what the legislature wants to do and that's what the governor wants to sign, it's going to happen.
Right.
And so that's the bad side of it. But the good side of it, in my own work, we ran things like Prop 21, which was a real step forward trying to deal with gang violence and also kind of some of the mm-hmm. juvenile issues. One of the other things I'm proud of is Prop 69, which was a DNA proposition. California is one of those states you can try at the Capitol. If you can't get at the Capitol, you can go to the voters. And unfortunately, like with the DNA issue, it required a crime victim to stand up. His brother and sister-in-law, they were slaughtered. They were killed by and rape, and it was absolute awful crime. That there's a DNA profile. There's just never been a DNA match. And so, mm-hmm. again, here was an individual who had tremendous resources. He was an attorney. He was a developer, but he had never been in the criminal justice system. And then he looks at the justice system and says, "Why don't you have DNA profiles? Why?" and that was based on California law at that point, why are you taking it from only the violent offenders? You know, don't you realize burglars, you know, are one of the most awful folks out there. If they're willing to break in your home and steal your stuff, if somebody's in there, you can either have sexual assault things or homicide itself. You know, look at your theft offenders. Look at your drug. What do you think somebody happens when somebody's strung out on drugs and they need that next fix? Do you think that they're going to stop and not do a violent offense? Absolutely not.
Yeah. No,
and so in that sense, so when you talk about changing things, it's like, okay, let's get the profiles. Let's get them from all the felons. Let's look at the sex offenders, the arsons, and others even in the area of misdemeanors. And further, if somebody's arrested for a felony, why aren't we taking a sample? I mean, how hard is that to take? Because we know that that there still, within our communities, there's only a few number of folks, but they're causing the majority of the damage. So let's get them sampled. Let's get them into a database. That also addresses an issue many times that people arrested sometimes forget what their name is. And with states that are common law states, you can use whatever name you choose. They don't want to identify themselves. They want to identify themselves to be the brother, the cousin, somebody they know that has a clean criminal record. So even though they've been arrested, they can get out quickly and hopefully never get held accountable. You do things like a DNA database, and as science gets better and better, now whether or not the individual can remember who they are, at least the system itself can identify those folks. So that's a way of saying at the state level, how do we change the laws overall? How do we improve the system of justice? And,
well, our state is an example with the early release of the bad way. You know, governor signed it. So, you know, each state is different. And with respect to that, you know, I find it sort of remarkable that when you're talking about California, that going to the people seems to be the most effective route of changing things, where that just doesn't happen in a lot of other states. It gets bogged down in the legislature or however else they seem to do it. And going to the people seems to be, to me, the most efficient and effective way. After all, they were elected to represent us.
Absolutely, and that's one of those things that you know, as we chatted early, you know, United States really doesn't have one justice system. It has 51. It's 51 separate justice systems, and then even within that, when you break down the major states, you look at New York. Their procedure in courts are different for New York City than they are for all of the rest of the counties of New York. Same thing when you go to Pennsylvania. You know, Philadelphia has its system. The rest of the state has their own. So the justice system itself is incredibly fragmented. And then when you talk about reforming that system, that becomes that focus. How do you do it? You know, is there a way that the elected – well, and then some prosecutors are elected and others are appointed. You know, and so where do you go there? But assuming you have an elected official, when you talk about, you know, voters stepping forward, but assuming you have an elected official, if that elected official is willing to step forward and do something, what is his or her zone of influence? What is it that they can really do? And yes, most folks are frustrated with their capitals, especially when you look at issues like criminal justice and especially in the area of things like victims' rights. That's not the attention of a lot of capitals.
Yeah. You know, if I can go back to, like, a question that might be, you know, prosecution 101, and maybe there are some people listening that do not understand the reason for this, but if you can clarify with this, when there is a crime committed and a prosecutor is assigned, many people going into the situation feel as if that prosecutor is representing the victim's family, and they are not. They're representing the state, correct? They're not representing the family themselves. And if that is so, can you explain to people why that is?
Absolutely, and probably doing a little prosecutor 101 is a great place to kind of start and move in that discussion about how do you work with whoever gets assigned to the case. As I alluded to before, and let's just, for this discussion right now, talking about crime, let's just stick to felony crimes. Because if we get down to misdemeanors and summaries or infractions, it even gets more complicated and more fragmented. But very generally, when you talk about felony crimes across the country, that is the place that an event occurs, a crime, somebody is victimized. You have a victim to that crime. That crime is investigated. There's an investigatory agency, and that agency then arrests someone and brings that individual likely in front of a court. Prior to the investigatory agency's activities, there's no involvement in prosecutors' offices. There are very, very few cases that prosecutors will start an investigation into. Things like public corruption is one of the areas that offices have investigators, and they'll do it independently. But other than that, as you just mentioned, the public prosecutor is neither the victim's attorney nor are they the police's attorney. And that's the area that many people believe right away that particular office is representing one of those two entities. In fact, we are not. We are trying to hold the offender. We are the public's attorney, and we are trying to hold the offender fully accountable for his actions on behalf of the public as a whole, with that victim, in fact, being what we would refer to as a complaining witness. Or, you know, that's sort of issue there. So when you talk about trying to assist that victim, you know, now they've got issues in their job. They are out money because of it. They need medical care. Now, many of those issues can be handled by that local prosecutor through the victim witness office and through seeking restitution and those sorts. But as far as going into court and saying, on behalf of this individual, I want the defendant to do this, that is the civil system, which allows one individual to sue another individual, and in that situation, if they can afford it, each of them can go get their own attorneys. But one of the key things that has been very helpful, and there used to be some federal funding for it, but some states are still doing it, is really moving in the direction of trying to get some sort of victim's counsel or victim support, especially to get the things that the victims are entitled to.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that makes sense to me. I've heard that explanation before, but like I say, maybe it is something that is not known in general. And historically, is that the way it's been? If we look at the role of a prosecutor from like decades ago up until today, can you perhaps address what it was? How it was and how the job of a prosecutor has evolved into what it is today, for good or for bad. Can you give us a little bit of a historical perspective on it?
Certainly. And probably what is helpful to talk about what's really occurred with the area of victims' rights, because it's not only impacted the role of the individual prosecutor, but there's also been systemic reform in the same way.
Yes.
If you want to, and actually, if you go very far back and go back to the old British system, folks used to be able to go hire their own prosecutor. So you can go far enough back in the system where those that had money could get a prosecutor, those that didn't couldn't. The system is nothing is ever new in criminal justice, but the significant systemic changes were that there's always been a right to counsel. There's been a constitutional right to counsel, but for so long the victims were the ones left out in the system. So when you talk about prosecutor issues, it probably is the 70s when you have the emergence of at least let's get the victims a voice. You know, shouldn't they be allowed to be present at arraignments? If there's going to be a sentencing, shouldn't they be allowed to speak? You know, should they be notified upon the release of an offender? So just focusing on the band of as it relates to the prosecutor, making mm-hmm. prosecutors aware, look, you need to reach out to the victim. It's just not a paper case. It's not just getting to court and getting whatever the sentence range is, or, again, in older systems, it was indeterminate, so you're saying, well, it's a range A, it's 5 to 10 years, that's the right range for this crime. The individual's now into the penitentiary, we're on to the next case. Very different world, even then you say the last couple of decades, 80s, 90s, you know, 2000s, and now the 10s, of mm-hmm. more and more notice, more in things like the you know, Vine. There was resistance, absolutely, if you want to go ahead and say bad things about prosecutors, which I don't mind at all. There's certainly plenty of room for criticism. But that the victim does have a voice, needs to have a voice, and if we're going to get some balance in the system, if we're going to reform the system, and if we're going to actually try to be proactive and reduce violence in communities, we've got to get that voice in there as part of the system, adding that expertise and getting some reality as to what's occurring in the courtroom. It's really not that difficult. Again, I said I was started in California as a trial prosecutor. It's not that hard to pick up the phone. It's not that hard with email and now with the world of texting and everything else to get a hold of your victim. And I'll use the phrase your victim because it mm-hmm. is. It's the victim in that case. Get a hold of them. Let them know what's going on. Hear what's going on within their life as a result of this crime. If there are some services that you can hook them up with, get them the services. Are there protection issues? Are they being harassed? You know, can you relocate them somewhere? It's not that hard, and that's one of the things that I point out right away with training, is if you're right. handling property crimes or drug crimes, it's no big deal. I mean, if in fact you didn't get a hold of that police officer can still call into your prosecuting agency and cause you a lot of pain. The prosecutor never called me, but there's no excuse when you have a victim in your case that victim doesn't know what particular prosecutor is handling that case. So good, bad, or indifferent, it was one of the things that right away I always worked with is, here's my name, here's my phone number. So if there was a complaint or if the case didn't work out right, because that happens so often, that at least mm-hmm. when they're calling into a prosecutor's office, there's nothing worse when they're going above your head because of a complaint, that they say, I don't know who that prosecutor was, but here's the terrible thing that happened in the case.
Right.
It's always
and
better if they can start out.
The exception rather than the rule, because so many over the years since my dad's homicide 32 years ago, you always hear this complaint of, well, there's so-and-so prosecutor, and just their style of doing a trial is that they have very minimal contact with the victim, or that's what the victim advocate is for, to serve as an intermediary, or, you know, they never keep me abreast of what's going on, or I call them, or I do this, and it's just very individual, whereas I think it sounds like with your APA organization, you're trying to set the bar higher than it really is in reality, set the standard for what the interaction and what it should be like between the victim and the prosecutor. It shouldn't be like an ivory tower existence and, oh, well, you should be calling the victim advocate, don't bother me, or I'm too busy. I'm so glad to hear you say this, but, you know, is that the way it – is it getting better with respect to that, at least with the people that you're training, that they're picking up the phone, they're emailing and saying, well, just call this number, the victim advocate has more time than I do, or whatever?
Well, that to me is always the test. Is, and I speak to a lot of victims and have a good amount of contact. I get plenty of victims and especially complaints. In fact, the other day I got a compliment about a prosecutor in Texas, which was really nice, and I reached out to the victim.
Great.
And said, thank you. It's really good to hear, you know, because he was impressed of how well, and he called me a young man, really did a nice job in my case. But, yes, that becomes the complaint. We didn't know. We didn't, you know, we weren't involved. And, again, I'm going to say that many times there's huge disappointments as to what happens with a case. And prosecutors are absolutely falling down in their job and responsibilities when they're not including the victim and letting the victim know. You know, it's not an easy call to make, But that's what happened. That's the reality. So let's work through whatever has happened in the court. Let's work through whatever the jury did or the parole decision. So, yeah, sometimes it's not a pleasant phone call to make, but it needs to be done. When you talk about my organization and things that we are doing, both with and on behalf of prosecutors, is very much that piece. We're not involved. We're not satisfied with what the system is. I'm not a Dr. No here in D.C. saying, no, you know, we can't do this and no, we can't do that. Instead, my work, and especially the work with the larger offices, is where should the system be? How can we make it better? And the victims' rights and notification and the things we're discussing is a big piece of that. And again, as I said, things like the zones and, you know, how can we break very large communities down to smaller communities so we can actually have some services? Because we would like mm-hmm. people to be calling the prosecutor's office, and when they're in trouble or, you know, something going on with the case or they need some services, that should be the place. And, you know, probably one of the main reasons that I work with a lot of the larger offices is, you know, and yes, they have more resources than the smaller, but so often with the small offices, and I worked in one, they are so impacted, they are so understaffed, they have so many cases that they're spending their entire life just trying to keep their head above the water. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you say individualized, particular areas, particular prosecutors, yes, there are absolutely, you know, and there's tens of thousands of prosecutors in this country. There are better ones, and there are, than, you know, as with every profession. But right. with a lot of the smaller offices, they don't have the staff. They're doing the very best thing they can, but they have a really hard time trying to look and get any vision. And what I'm trying to do nationally is, how do we get some vision? Where should we be going? How do we do this? How can you do things with limited resources? And I'm going to kind of end this discussion with, my test is when they talk about their case, it's whether or not they use the phrase, my prosecutor. Because any victim or survivor or family, when they start up talking about their case and they use the phrase, my prosecutor, that means to me that they felt as though they were involved in the case, our case, mm-hmm. we did. They'll even talk about things like jury selection. Those are cases where there was good contact. Yes, maybe there were times they said, hey, can you talk to the advocate? You know, I'm really sorry. You know, today I've got this other case, but here, talk to Donna. Talk to Delilah. I think she can mm-hmm. she can help you. If she can't, get back with me.
Right.
You know,
right.
call me after 5 tonight. I'll be at my desk.
Yeah.
And we'll see what we can do next. Or
I love that you give people an option and don't just say, I'm sorry, I can't take your call right now. You say, okay, I can't help you now, but, you know, you leave the door open, which is, to me, is wonderful, and it's humanistic. And I find it very interesting with the background in speech pathology that you're saying the language they use, you know, if they say my prosecutor, so they're humanizing it, and they're saying, yes, they felt that relationship with you. So that's very interesting and intriguing to me, David. That's wonderful, you know, that really is.
I think it says a lot, too, that, you know, you're fighting for the victims' voices to be heard, and there's not too many opportunities for those voices to be heard through their surviving family members other than a victim impact statement, which leads mm-hmm. right into one of the resources that Donna is trying to provide now, is to help families professionally write an impact statement that brings across their feelings, but yet a lot of people just don't know how to put it all in words so that they truly get what they want into the court record through that statement. And mm-hmm. I know there are a lot of other services out there, but this, I think, you know, Donna is getting ready to provide a very, very needed service for victims.
Absolutely.
Yes, thank you, Delilah. I am starting, in case you don't know, David, and the rest of the listening audience, a customized victim impact writing service, tailoring it to the particular family or victim's needs. If they're not a wordsmith, if they're too emotional, if they just don't know what to do, and we're just getting it off the ground now. I think I have my first client, but you know, it's kind of hard. I don't know. I haven't had a lot of feedback from people on social media, so I'll just put it out there right now. And it's so good of you to mention it, Delilah. Thank you so much in respect to David, because I can do my part there too, because there's just not a lot out there. You know, there might be a few templates, and the victim advocate may say, oh, I'll help you write it. We had somebody talk to us and say, well, the parole officer or somebody wants to, will offer it, and she said, I don't think so. So, you know, there is, it's, David, it may be a niche market, just like what you're doing, but this is what I'd like to do and as another means of helping crime victims. So that's the end of my little speech.
That's outstanding, because that is such an important thing, is trying to get the voice in and trying to make certain. I mean, you can never bring that individual back. You can never, you know, really find all the right words to say what the loss is to that individual or that family or that community. On the other hand, if nothing's in there, or if it's very poorly drafted or very short, you know, many of us aren't going to be around potentially whenever that parole date is coming up or whatever, or an appeal or whatever that issue might be. And that may be the only thing that's in the file, as to try to help those that are working on the file at that moment to put a face on it. Wait, you know, look what he did. Look what he did to mm-hmm. this family, and make sure that voice is there. So I think it's a fabulous idea. One of the other things I always try to push is one of the methods of changing government is changing those forms. And there have been some very excellent, it's Riverside advocate, Marty Crawford, that one of the things she did is she created a pink form, because not only did she want to make sure that there was a victim impact statement in that file, but she also wanted that victim impact statement to stand out. And so,
well, another thing I might mention to you is that during the parole hearing for our multiple offender after 32 years this past spring, we brought up the idea with our victim advocate of the fact that my mom was 80 years old, and this was absolutely devastating for her, and she may not be allowed, was not willing to go through this. The idea, although she didn't want to do it, and I respect that, the idea of videotaping that final victim impact statement, if they say this is the last one I can do, that memorializes, that captures, just like Delilah, document the abuse. That videotape is there, just like the paper and the file. And David, isn't a paper and a file, excuse me, that could get lost. So what do you think about the idea of actually videotaping those? That could be part of my service, too, that we're thinking of.
I think that that's a fabulous idea, because one of the things that I say when people say, well, videotape is so expensive, so it's like, wait a second, you know, all of us have a phone in our pocket. What is one of the functions that phone has? It has video capability. There is no reason, and like you said, yes, a paper and a file. The only reason I suggest the paper and file is a method of how do you make things stand out, you know, because a lot of the justice system is still paper. So how do you get your paper to make sure that somebody actually looks at it and reads it, especially over time? But, yes, creating something electronic and creating it so it's permanent and making sure those involved later in the process know, hey, she couldn't go through it, and why isn't she here, or why isn't he here, to say, look, they've been here X number of times, and whether it's age or they just can't go through it anymore, and so now here is an electronic representation of their position. It's not that they don't care. It's the opposite. This is they are feeling so much pain. They're being re-victimized so often by coming to these hearings, especially if you get things like annual hearings and then supplemental file, you know, supplemental hearings. You know, they too have a life, and they too, many of them were given assurances that this person would never get out. And now they're 20 years later, or you keep talking of your case, 32 years later, you know, you haven't forgotten. many people involved in that may have forgotten, or the system may very well have changed. There may have been legislation that has now created an opportunity for release.
So no one should ever make promises, but I'll have to send you the information about it. We'll make sure. So thank you. That's very thoughtful, and I'm so glad we're on the same page in terms of this. With respect to your organization, because we want to focus on some of that as well, how do you actually get brought in? Or are you trying to market yourself? I mean, here we are. We're trying to help you market this wonderful organization. But do you get calls and say, hey, we need help? Or how does it actually go? And how have you been received since you've been doing this? I believe you said since 2009. I'm sure you have some success stories too.
Oh, absolutely. So first, when you talk about marketing, thank you on that. And, you know, we are a private 501c3 nonprofit charity. We literally, you talk about your 2 years, the 20th of January was the beginning of our organization. So tomorrow we have now been around for 5 years.
Wow, congratulations. Wonderful.
Yeah, the primary source of funding, especially for our training, what we call technical assistance, going out and trying to help offices, the primary source of funds for my organization is federal grants, is grants from the U.S. Department of Justice. Mm-hmm. However, anybody is welcome. It's $25 to sign up as a member, to get into our site, see what it is we're doing. We very much appreciate it. We try to keep the cost incredibly low, especially in the areas like victims, because we know all of you didn't get into the system by choice.
Not for prosecutors, is that right, David?
It's not just for prosecutors. We realize we cannot impact and work the system. You know, our focus as prosecutors, my board and my president's advisory council are you know, the prosecutors or the chief prosecutors, but absolutely not. The majority of the work that I personally do is with folks, especially at the deputy level, you know, that they're having, like you said, you know, what happens. Someone is having trouble in a particular case, and they're sending that lifeline out saying, please help me. And so that's a lot of the work we do. If you go up onto our website, a little more marketing, it's apainc.org. Look up there. There's a request for technical assistance right up in the right-hand corner. You know, so anybody or somebody knows of an office that's having some struggles, fill it out. We'll go there. But we respond to victim complaints. Obviously prosecutor complaints concerns, as well as the police agencies.
Well, perhaps another thing we can do is put your APA logo on my website. We could do that, right, Delilah?
Yeah, sure can.
Yeah, If you think that would help, I'd be glad to do that as well.
Yeah, love to have the links. And then when you talk about, you know, working with other national, so U.S. Department of Justice is a big piece, but the other national organizations, the national sheriffs, the IACP, I know you had Will Marling on behalf of NOVA. I know you had Dan Levy with Parents of Murdered Children. That's the other piece of collectively all of the national organizations. How do we do things better? How do we do things different? Who is having trouble and where, and can somebody else step in and try to assist? So that's, you know, what we do. We do conferences. We do webinars. The 31st, so it's not next week. It's the week thereafter. We do final Fridays at 3, from 3 to 4 on Fridays, Eastern time. We run a free one-hour webinar. Gives continuing legal education. We happen to have one coming up on the Portland, on the community or what they call neighborhood prosecutors. Back to your topic, how do you change things? How do you make things better? How do you, you know, get prosecutors out of that courtroom, even out of that office, and assign them into communities and let the community members talk about what's of issue to them? Because, you know, I was up in Manhattan. It had nothing to do with drug trafficking, gangs, robberies. Even purse snatching, that wasn't the issue. It was the bicycles on the sidewalks. You know, they don't like the messenger.
And you wouldn't have known that if you didn't go into the community, is what
you're saying. You've got to go in the community and you got to listen. Philadelphia, I was at another meeting. It was all about the grease. and you kind of say, what? And you know, it's the restaurants. It's incredibly costly, apparently, to get rid of the fats and greases. And so there were some folks that were dumping things into alleys. And so, again, the community prosecutors, can you get up a video camera? Can you do something to try? First, you got to find out where it's coming from. But the community is definitely very worried about it, and that's their number one concern or issue right now. That's what they're talking about. So can you put some resources? Can you figure out where it's coming from? And then can you stop it? Is there criminal liability there? And can you address that? Because once you prosecute it in one place, it's probably going to stop it in others. So that's a little bit of that sort of strategy.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
The criminal justice system touches so much of everyday lives. But again, if the smaller issues or the things that are right in front of individuals are most concerned about, if they look at a prosecutor's office or police department and you can't stop the graffiti, how much do you think they're going to assist in the homicide?
Yeah, the small things are important, and then they just escalate up to larger issues. And if, you can't stop the graffiti, then how are you going to stop homicide? Yeah, very, very good point. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. Is there an answer?
That's why. What's your strategy? What are you doing? How? I think with offices, they ought to be measured not only with what's your conviction rate, how many cases you're filing. Okay, that's great. That's a standard kind of thing. But how are you being proactive? What kind of outreach are you doing? Do you have a community cabinet? Is there a way, the victim's voice? How are you communicating with your victim community, not just the victim on a particular case, but the victims overall? Is sex assault an issue? Is domestic violence an issue? The issues with folks that are, may or may not be lawfully in this country that are being victimized. Do they feel like they have a voice? Do they have an opportunity to talk, or do they believe if they step up and complain about being trafficked or other issues that suddenly, they themselves are the ones that are going to end up being prosecuted rather than the offenders? So, that's the question.
About nipping it in the bud, vigilantism and those kinds of things, right?
Right. That's the next net effect. Or having worked a lot of gang cases, can you work with that family? Can you work with the victims and the survivors to say, let the system do the payback? Don't you do the payback. You arm yourself, you go shoot somebody else. Now we're going to be prosecuting you. And now it's going to be even worse for your mom. So now she's lost two of her sons, one to being killed and the other away for life. That's not what anybody wants. But if they don't believe anything's going to be done, you're absolutely correct. That will be, you will continue. And there are some communities that very much feel that sort of hopelessness.
Yeah. Well, I just think that is the way to go, to be in touch with the community. It seems like it's very effective. I have a couple of just general questions. Maybe it goes back to the prosecuting 101, but just to let people know, in your opinion, two things. What do you think are the most important traits of an effective prosecutor? And there are some myths in terms of, or the most misunderstood aspects of the prosecutor job. Can you address those things?
Okay. Well, you're sent me in two different ways. So myths and best
keep me on your toes.
The thing to me, and I'll say two things. Let's go to the traits, and then we can head to the myths.
Okay.
With the traits, that was one thing you were chatting about earlier in working with victim and working cases. It's the system is a human system. Your jurors are human. Even the investigators, the police, and of course the individual that chose to go ahead and commit the crime.
Mm-hmm.
But it's human. It's literally kind of live theater. As far as a prosecutor, we don't get to choose. Okay, this is going to be our victim. This is going to be our defendant. It's just, as it comes. This event has occurred. Should the system be involved? If the answer is yes, is it the right person? What is the crime? And then, how do we hold that individual accountable, and what is that just decision? Well, in all of that, and we talk about attorneys, you'll see many of them, attorneys and counselor in law. I don't think a lot of us realized when we're sitting there in law school that part of the role of an attorney is ultimately being a counselor. Yes, there's the voice of being an advocate, but the other piece is working with others and looking at a trait for successful prosecutors. Many of them have two things, and I actually have both in my life, and that's what I kind of look at and see from others. One is, were they involved in sports, or were they involved in some sort of organized activities where they were coached, and where, you know, they're watching others, others are watching them, there's corrective things, do this, don't do that, and, you know, we're all incredibly smart people, right? We're all lawyers, and we know all the answers, but do you have that ability to, like, to listen to others and say, oh, you know, you're right, I really ought not to do that. That's not very effective. How do I change and become more effective, better advocate on behalf of the people, better at the job of, you know, holding folks accountable? The other piece is, you know, can you get along? The thing about coaching is working and as an athlete is, can you work as a team? It is a team. We earlier chatted about the victims when they say we, because I think that we piece is huge. You've got to get along with the investigators. You know, all of this you have no control over. You're handed these individuals. So can you get them to move collectively in a direction that you've got to prove the thing beyond a reasonable doubt, used to be a moral certainty as well, and you have to have all 12 jurors who don't know each other, don't watch TV, don't read anything, have no opinion about things going on in society at this moment, you know, cannot get out of jury duty. You know, that's the group that we're trying to convince, and get all 12 of those folks that have all that going on in their life to come to a decision that that we're going to hold this person accountable. So the other piece I think we talk about trait is how many were involved in food service. How many of them, like in my life, you know, were a waiter. You know, that you're walking up to a table, you're facing total strangers, they're hungry, they may or may not like what it is you're serving, but they came into your restaurant for some reason. Can you figure out what it is they want? Can you figure out what their time speed is? And can you get the kitchen or whoever's preparing that food to produce something that's going to land at their table and they're going to walk away happy? Because part of waiting is that immediate gratification of, I'd like to get a tip out of this. And the only way you're going to get a good tip is that they feel like the event which occurred. So those are kind of the traits is, can you move
it? That's an interesting analogy, a waiter to eventual prosecutor.
it's you need to have that, and the theater and others is you must be able to take that whole chaos and make some sense out of it, put it together as a story, but it's got to be human about it. If you're walking in there mechanic, you know, stiff and you know, just too judgmental, the jury's going to react to it, and it's not going to work out well.
Right. Very important.
I think when you talk about the myths, and see, that's because, but when you talk about traits, that is the trait that's important for your trial attorney, for your crimes against person prosecutor. It helps if the traits are also to your appointed or elected, but when you switch and you say, what about the chief prosecutor in that particular community? I would say the biggest trait with that individual is that individual must have a vision or a focus. Why is it that they wanted to become the chief prosecutor? And are they a voice within that community? Are they someone that the police are going to respond to, the community is going to respond to, the judges, whoever's funding them? There's lots of – so we've talked about all the things that the trial prosecutor has. The elected or the chief prosecutor has a lot of things going on in their world, but can they, in that same sort of manner and method, bring all of those folks together with a direction? And the other important thing about the direction is that those below them know, look, we've talked tonight about crime victims. The crime victim is a big deal. You know, I don't want to get a phone call and hear that they don't know who their prosecutor is. That's not going to work. We all know the system doesn't work out well many occasions, but they need to know who you are. And the other piece is you should have already told me. It shouldn't be that I have to hear from the outside that something didn't work out. So I think that's that sort of leadership trait. And when you talk about the organization, that's one of the things that we're working on. And one of the new projects we have is really work towards prosecutorial leadership. Management is one thing. You know, can you manage what it is you have? But leadership, do you know where you're going? Do you have a vision? Are you communicating that vision? Can you get others to follow in that direction? So I think that's the traits when you talk about the, you know, those above.
Very good.
I think myths, and I see we're coming up on the time a little bit.
We've got about 5 minutes.
when you talk about the myths, I think that you started early, you know, that the prosecutor is the victim's attorney. Probably even the, you know, that's the frustration on the victim side. I think with a lot of communities, the prosecutors, they just work for the cops. Or, conversely, the cops are going to do whatever we want. Or the issue like forensic sciences and DNA testing. Oh, all the DA, you know, that the DA can call the lab or the DA can call the coroner and, you know, change reports. You know, make it this person. That I think is a huge myth. You know, it's like, there's not a professional I know of out there that I can call and say, all right, the DNA test came back negative. Can you just adjust that, change the bands a little bit and make this person a suspect?
Yeah, right. Well, maybe on TV
it is, but it's just it's purely out there as a myth. I think a lot of the accusations as far as prosecutorial misconduct, we're trying to push and say, how much of that is truly misconduct? And if a prosecutor does something untoward, absolutely. Just as that person is holding others accountable, they too should be held accountable. But when it is something like a report was never provided to the prosecutor either, is that misconduct? Or is that really an error or flaw within the system?
A human error, yeah.
Yeah. So I really want us to get to the point that we really have prosecutorial error. Because, again, it's a human system. There are going to be errors. There are going to be mistakes. What's behind that? You know, how many decisions are made that are judgment call? And whether or not that's – and obviously because later, you know, after 90 appeals or whatever the incredible number in a lot of cases, you know, and things are looked at so microscopically that it loses the fact that this was one decision of 1,000 decisions. This was one thing that was happening at one – particular time in that trial, and any of us can get grumpy. We're advocates. We're fighting on different sides of a criminal case. We've got a judge up there that's supposed to be a referee. But when you start to impugn the integrity of the individual, you know, when you can look at all of the cases that they handled over an entire career, it's like, you know what? Can't anyone even make a particular mistake? And when they do make a mistake, that's fine. That's why we have appeals. But it's not a corrupt system, you know.
It's a human system, as you said.
Yeah. It seems that when you talk about the myths, it's like, you know, it's not a whole group of folks out there that are just out there trying to convict innocent people of things that never occurred. And the thing I like to joke about is, like, you know, what, do you think we pick up a phone book and, like, circle names and try to create crimes for them? It's not. We're responding to information we have been provided, trying to make calls on it, trying to do the very best thing we can. And, yes, mistakes are going to be made, and that's been another movement. And one of the things that we've been working on also is conviction integrity units, that when there is a mistake, when the case does get reversed, that office looks at it. How did that mistake happen? And how can we make sure it never happens again? But I think when you talk about myths, to think that prosecutors, they only care about convictions, they don't care about justice, you know, earlier, don't care about the victims, don't care about the defendants, that's not true.
That's a myth in and of itself, yeah.
Yeah.
Can you, in our parting few minutes or so, what would be your brief message to the listening audience in terms of victims, and then briefly give us your contact information? I'm going to ask you if you commit perhaps in the future to another show on a different topic, because I think it'd be very helpful.
Sure. Well, I thought you said you only have new people, so yeah. But of course, the parting message, the biggest message, is get involved. Mm-hmm. I have no qualms about somebody who's been involved, has complained, especially when, because I generally hear are the complaints and the concerns. And
well,
for someone to call me in Washington about something going on in their community and they haven't even gone, talked to that police department, talked to that prosecutor's office, gone to the victim advocate, that's not the place to start. Start locally. And if you have the time and resources, go out and do things right now in your community and make things better. You know, both your work and Delilah's work is you're really out there trying to improve the system and help
it's
anyone.
It's 6 o'clock.
Yeah, we are. Yes, and so we thank you so much. Can you briefly give us your contact information? And then we're going to have to sign off.
Absolutely.
Until the next show.
Yep. Phone number is 202-861-2480 is the association office number. Email is david.labahn, L-A-B-A-H-N, at apainc.org. And website is www.apainc.org. Same thing with Facebook. By all means, please contact us.
Okay, very good. Well, thank you so much. We're very indebted to you this evening. Thank you, and we'll have a good blog coming your way very soon. Thank you, my national audience. Have a good evening, and until next week. And Delilah, thank you so much, and we'll talk to you out there. Good evening, and be safe.
All right, stay warm.